A jail stint can really disrupt someone's life. You can lose a job, a relationship, or thousands of dollars on fees, fines, and bail.
Have I ever gone to jail? Yeah, I just got out, actually.
If he doesn't show up to court, you gotta pay the $50,000.
No ring exchange, no kiss the bride. There's no glamour in a jailhouse wedding.
Off the Block. All six episodes tracing the path from city block to jail block and back are now available on KCRW's iTunes page.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. Books.
Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt. Welcome to Bookworm. Today, my guest is Ann Patchett. We are sitting together on the occasion of the publication of her book, Commonwealth. It has just been learned that the book is making its debut as number one on the New York Times bestseller list. We're taping. That debut will occur in a week. I feel incredibly fortunate to be able to be with her when this news is brand new. Did you ever expect that this would be to start at number one?
You know, it's funny. Certainly not when I was writing the book, but I own a bookstore, and I have a much more complex understanding of these things than I ever did. So I had a sense from the number of pre-orders that we had and the number of books I had signed in advance of this coming out. I thought it was going to be good. I didn't think it was going to be this good, but I thought it was going to be good.
You know, I've been reading and talking to Ann Patchett for a very long time, and I think that this is the funniest, most unpredictable, and richest of her novels. And tell me first, what is a commonwealth as it applies to this book?
Well, in the simplest sense, it is the Commonwealth of Virginia, which is where much of the action in the book takes place and where the families are brought together. But it's also that sense of a central agency which looks after many smaller agencies that are brought together and held together under one umbrella of government or family.
You see, this book begins in a suburb of L.A. It begins in Downey. And a lot of people from Downey who want more than Karen Carpenter as a mascot will be made very happy by Commonwealth. It opens at an extraordinary party where an uninvited guest comes to a christening party. He kisses the mother of the new baby, and there's an electricity in that kiss that alters the future of two families. The uninvited guest, by the end of that chapter, is preparing to leave his wife, and the mother of the child is preparing to leave her husband. It's kind of amazing how much happens, how quickly. Now, this is a party with over 100 guests, and Anne goes from room to room, from gin and orange juice to gin and orange juice. And I thought it would be wonderful to hear the first paragraph and listen to this stage management. It's incredible.
The christening party took a turn when Albert Cousins arrived with gin. Fix was smiling when he opened the door, and he kept smiling as he struggled to make the connection. It was Albert Cousins from the district attorney's office standing on the cement slab of his front porch. He'd opened the door 20 times in the last half hour, to neighbors and friends and people from church and Beverly's sister and all of his brothers and their parents and practically an entire precinct worth of cops. But Cousins was the only surprise. Fix had asked his wife 2 weeks ago why she thought they had to invite every single person they knew in the world to a christening party, and she'd handed over the guest list and asked at him who he thought they should cut. He hadn't had an answer at the time, but if she were standing at the door now, he would have pointed straight ahead and said, him. Not that he disliked Albert Cousins. He didn't know him other than to put his name together with his face. But not knowing him was the reason not to invite him. Fix had thought that maybe Cousins had come to his house to talk about a case. Nothing like that had ever happened before, but what else was the explanation? Guests were milling around in the front yard, and whether they were coming late or leaving early or just taking refuge outside because the house was packed beyond what any fire marshal would allow, Fix couldn't say. What he was sure of was that Cousins was there uninvited, alone with a bottle in a bag.
Okay, Ann Patchett reading the first paragraph from her new novel, Commonwealth. I've known a lot of people named Francis Xavier. I didn't know the nickname Fix, which makes perfect sense to me. Fix is a cop, but he's a cop who owns a Peugeot, and he has a very sexy watch, and this district attorney is made suspicious. Because of this ownership of material goods. Now, as a Jew, I didn't know that you don't bring a big bottle of gin to a christening party, but especially if the christening party is with a bunch of Irish Catholics. The novel takes place in Southern California, so everyone has orange trees, and they don't have gin and tonic, they have gin and orange juice. It's the drink that loosens
right.
the morality all over the room and will lead to the dissolution of two marriages. And you have mentioned that your books, all of them, are about people who don't know each other finding themselves in a community in which everything is reshaped by their new situation. And certainly that's the case here. But here in Commonwealth, how many years do we spend knowing these characters?
52.
Yes. The book takes generations. We meet what is clearly in his old age one of the most beautifully moral cops to ever walk the face of the earth. These characters grow more and more powerfully self-revealed as the book continues. Was that one of your intentions?
No, it's not. I would never have been that conscious to say, I'm going to start out with characters who have human flaws and make them more deeply human. And yet, that's what characters should always do in my mind. The reader should follow them into the depths of their nature. And my books had become very time constrained. My novels tended to take place over 3 or 4 weeks, or in the case of Run, 24 hours. So I really wanted to write a book that covered a long period of time. And I think any time I look at people over a long period of time, it's going to be to follow the deepening and complexity of their humanity.
It's very beautiful because what I think of as the great novels, which are for me the Russian novels. I'm a Russian Jew. They're the ones that take place over generations. Each chapter here, we turn the page and we're 20 years later. Or we turn the page and we've moved from Southern California to Virginia. How did you navigate a book that had so much time, so much movement, so many characters, and so many surprises?
You know, it takes me a couple of years to write these things, and if they aren't hard, I can't stay interested. And so every time I write a book, I come up with a new list of tasks for myself to accomplish. It's puzzle working, and I really like that part of it. How can I have so many people, differentiate them, and make them cover a long period of time?
It moves effortlessly From description to an almost conversational style, you describe the conversations that people are having, not necessarily quoting the conversation, but showing us these people in their attitudes, and I can hear them. I can see them, I can hear them, and it seems to me one of your gifts is to move narrative along in surprising and unexpected ways. When you wrote Run, it was about writing an action novel. Mm-hmm. Can you do a novel that's all action? But I think with Commonwealth, the question was, can I write an old-fashioned great novel? You know, like Middle March, taking decades, going through political upheavals and moral upheavals in the nation that you're writing about and its people. It's really a spectacular accomplishment. Now tell me, because you have so much room between the chapters, did you throw a lot out? Were there things you wrote that you realized, I don't need this, out with it?
You know, there were not a huge number of things, but I think when I think about this book, I think if there's anything you want to admire about this book, admire my restraint, because this could have been an 800-page novel so easily. It can go off in any of these different directions, but there would be scenes that I loved in the book that I just wasn't sure it did anything to move the scene forward, to move the whole book forward. And I would take those scenes out and I would put them in a separate file and say to myself, if the next time you read this chapter, you miss that moment, then it can come back. But if you're not actively longing for that moment and thinking about it, then it has to stay out. And everything that I took out stayed out. I'm very disciplined in that way.
Well, it was very interesting to me to realize that you are, because I've read the essays about your discipline in the book, the last book. It was a collection of essays. This is the story of a happy marriage. In a way, this is the story of a happy family.
Thank you. Because I think it is, too. And I have met people who have said, this is such a funny book. This is so much like life. And then I have met other people who have said, this is the saddest, saddest book. When my publisher sent me the jacket copy and the catalog copy, and it said, you know, this heartbreaking tale of tragedy and loss. And I said, no, I have to rewrite all the copy. This is actually a really funny book. This is a laugh riot of a family.
Yes. Well, they endanger one another.
Sure.
They jeopardize one another. They frighten and sadden one another. But yes,
that's
you're quite right.
That's what families do. That's their responsibility.
Now, I'm curious. You co-own the Parnassus Bookstore in Nashville, Tennessee. A lot of people have saluted you for moving into independent bookstore owning just at the time when people thought it could no longer be done. But did you learn more about what readers, what shoppers want to see in a novel by being in a bookstore?
Yes, I certainly have. And we always talk about the fact that the book we wish we had 100 more versions of is Maria Semple's Where You Go, Bernadette. Because that's the book that people come in and say, I want a really happy, upbeat novel that's smart and funny. That is not the book I wrote. But what I see and how owning a bookstore influences my writing is I see what's missing. And for me, what is missing was a book about a modern family that was as rangy and complicated and messy and enormous as my own.
Commonwealth, by my guest Ann Patchett, the book we're talking about today. This young daughter, Franny, who, of course, is her father's daughter. He's Francis Xavier. She's Francis. And she is one of those, like so many of us, She flunks out of law school. She doesn't know what she wanted to be. And one night when she's waiting in a fancy bar, a fancy Chicago bar, she meets one of her very favorite writers. She's a reader. His name is...
Leo Posen.
And she tells him the story of her family.
Not that night, but they begin an affair, and over the course of her affair, she tells him the story of her family.
He's a blocked writer. She's a blocked liver. She doesn't know. And so,
that's a good way to put it.
Being with someone who's interested in your family and why you're having so much trouble moving forward, if I were in that family, I'd be so dazzled by what all of these, now you've got suddenly not a sister, you've got altogether five other siblings, and one of them, well, I'll say it, puts ketchup on his pancakes and grows up to be a heroin addict. The implication is that there's no surprise there.
Right, right.
So she has loads of stories. And he writes a book called Commonwealth and introduces one of the subjects of this book, which is, who is the owner in a commonwealth? Who owns the stories? I wondered, who does own a story?
I have wrestled with this for as long as I've been writing, and I've just come to the point in my life that if I was there and I was in it, it's going to be mine. And that we all own the stories. They're co-ops. Lots of people own the same stories. But if we were there and it's our life, it is our story.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. And I'm talking with Ann Patchett about her novel, Commonwealth. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
Listen to the Rhythm Planet podcast to explore music from all corners of the globe. Brazilian, European, African, and tropical Latin. Rhythm Planet is a state of mind. Listen at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet or on KCRW's app.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Ann Patchett about her latest novel, Commonwealth, published by Harper. It's a terrific book. It's a book about love and the connections and stories that form from it and who owns those stories to tell. Now, just as you say that anything you've witnessed belongs to you as a writer, I was privileged the first time I met you to meet your father, mm-hmm. who was a policeman. Mm-hmm. To what extent is what you know about the police the result of knowing your father?
To every extent of what I know. I mean, which is not to say that the character of Fix Keating is my father, but I was very glad to be able to say, you know what? I'm going to write a character who's a cop in L.A. I know a lot about cops in L.A. I have a lot of access to that information. I grew up in that world, and it was great to be able to use that because I think that 3 books ago, 5 books ago, I would have thought that just belongs to my father and I can't use it because that's his life. But it was my life too, because that is how I grew up.
Now, what year are we meeting Fix?
I'm going to say 1963 because that was the year I was born.
It's a completely different picture of the policeman than the picture of the cop that we have today. This is back at a time where still we were being told the policeman is your friend.
Mm-hmm.
I felt that one of the things that Commonwealth did was to remind us of a time before things had gone off their track. You know, you wouldn't have to hide from the policemen in this novel. They may not have been the most worldly people, but they knew better than to shoot without warning, I feel. And so it's a very interesting, moving thing to go back to an earlier era of civic virtue.
Yes, and that certainly is the era that imprinted on me. And I have to say, no matter how many terrible cops there are out there doing horrible things, there are so many more of them out there who are still working to protect and to serve in a very dangerous job.
I remember your father coming into the station. He was so gracious.
Lovely.
And so shy.
No, he was a great, great man. He really was.
He wasn't threatening to arrest me. This is an Ann Padgett novel. That boy, Albie, who puts ketchup on his pancakes and who becomes a heroin addict, is not that by the end of the book.
Right.
There is, in the world of your books, some kind of intrinsic goodness. There are threats from outside, always. That's what makes a novel. But I was very happy to be shown yet again how people can save themselves. Not all of them do, of course. There's a character who dies. You know, I'm not going to say which. Sometimes death is extraordinarily random. And I would say that this book, in a way, is not only about goodness, it's about the randomness with which it falls. That life is possible only because it's unpredictable.
Yes. I think that's very true, and it's one of the real benefits of writing a book that covers a long period of time, because many people do redeem themselves. Many people who are terrible, irritating children and reckless, endangering youths, in fact, grow out of that and settle down. And when I look at my group of siblings and my group of friends, people, you just get to a certain age, you think, well, I've known you for 50 years, and I've seen all the ways you've changed and come into your deepest, truest self. These characters change, and yet they are still essentially themselves.
What I loved, as beautiful as the opening chapter was, and many of the chapters are really bravura feats, the final chapter takes us back to a party, and one of our characters is sitting outside remembering still another party. And that syntax of memory, of party within party, of story within story, of the present within the past, is so masterfully handled within this essentially internal monologue. How proud of you? How proud were you of that last chapter?
Well, the last moment in that last chapter, I knew the structure. I knew it would end with the party. I knew it would end with then a third family, the mother's third marriage. I knew who needed to come back around and have another moment on stage. But I didn't have a story, and I wanted a story that was unimportant, that was common, and a moment, like a note. It really is like finding the note at the end of the symphony. And I felt that I had finished the book, and yet I knew there were going to be another 5 pages at the very end that would be a small, common tale, and that would be the note to end on. And I didn't have it, and I didn't have it. And then really one morning I was washing the dishes and thought, yep, there it is. Now I've got it. And I ran upstairs and typed it up and thought, book's done.
Well, it took my breath away. Tell me, there are characters in this novel who fall by the wayside. Mm-hmm. One dies, one marries outside. What do you do? Do you heighten the wish that readers will have to hear more about the people we've lost? I got the sense that part of the mastery of this book was that you created as much curiosity about the people we learn about as the people we don't.
Well, and I think that's very important, that the reader has a responsibility to be interactive with the novel, and that I, as a writer, want to give the reader just enough information so that he can go forward and think about these people in his own mind, in his own life, that I am not spelling everything out. One of the moments, though, as a writer that was so great is when the character of Teresa, who is very elderly, and I don't think it's giving anything away to say that Teresa dies, and I felt so surprised by how sad I was. She's not one of the major characters in the book. And when I finished that chapter, I thought, I want her back. And so I just dropped back in time 10 years and then gave her own chapter. That felt great.
It's lovely because although up until that point she's not a major character, she could have been.
Yes.
She's a part of the family that we don't follow.
She's the part that's abandoned.
And it's like in this sudden chapter, she's auditioned and she gets the part. It's so wonderful to see that Teresa, in her final years, in her final days, actually,
yes,
is given a little romance, the possibility that she, wouldn't it have been something if she had married the cop,
right,
you know, who now is himself very old and on his death, near his death. You know, it's a kind of lovely pas de deux that's then completed by an ecstatic dream ballet.
You know, it is really interesting. I think that opera has had such an enormous effect on my brain and how things are structured. And not the experience so much of writing Bel Canto, but the experience then of meeting all of the opera singers that I met because of that book, spending so much time going to operas because I had friends who had who were opera singers, and then they made an opera out of Bel Canto. And I think I am always thinking in operatic terms. So what you're saying is exactly correct.
I've been talking with Anne Padgett, the author of Commonwealth, published by Harper. Thank you, Anne, for joining me again and for showing me that as much as I liked your last novel, State of Wonder, that you could even outdo that. It's really a terrific book.
Michael, you always make me feel so much smarter than I am, and I'm so grateful to you. I've really appreciated this time.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Commonwealth at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to David Sobel, my assistant. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Tessa Hadley is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.